I'm telling these tears, go and fall away, fall away. Oh, may the last one burn into flames. Freedom, freedom, I can't move. Freedom.
What is up, Wisconsin? I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Happy Friday, everybody. I'm pumped. The Brewers are playing tonight. I'm going. And we have Brewers tickets to give away. We'll do so this hour. We got about three sets of tickets. So you're going to want to stay tuned for all that. And we got a great show lined up for everybody today. Of course, we're going to listen to a little bit of Vice President Kamala Harris as then Senator Harris taking on Brett Kavanaugh during the Senate Judiciary Committee Supreme Court confirmation hearings. Got to take care of that business. We're going to take a listen to some of the ridiculous things that J.D. Vance has said about women and having kids and Donald Trump popping off about Jewish folks and Kamala not really knowing about Jewish folks, except for the fact that she's married to one. You know, who knows? We're also going to be joined at 2:30 by a very special guest. This is Bryna Godard, a staff attorney with the State Democracy Research Initiative at the University of Wisconsin Law School. She's going to be talking to us about what I think is one of the most important things that you're going to see in this next election cycle. And it's coming on the primary ballot on August 13th. That's two constitutional amendments that conservatives are trying to, skirt the rules to get done because they couldn't get it done legislatively. We've got the president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, Rob Henken, at 3:00. And we have a brand new candidate in the political game. Her name is Amelia Heredia. She's running for the 11th District State Assembly. In the State Assembly, she's going to join us as well. So much to get to. And finally, we'll do a little bit of who do you think should be Kamala Harris's vice presidential pick? We're going to do it in the form of the dating game, try to have a little fun with that. So much and more. But Brian, let's jump right back in where we left off yesterday. So very, very important. One of the things I've heard repeated from folks on the right is Kamala Harris doesn't speak well, which what? I don't know. But it's like so stupid and it's completely a racist dog whistle, right? I mean, how can people even think of this?
I believe that there's an entire Chris Rock bit about speaking so well and what that means.
I think there is too, my friend. It's just a ridiculous criticism. I think I said yesterday, I have spoken in court for years. I've spoken in public committee hearings, both at the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. I've obviously been doing a little bit of radio. If you listen to every minute of what I've said on the record over nearly 15 years, there'll be some misspeaks, and Vice President Harris speaks more than I do publicly. So yeah, of course, everybody's going to have a little stumble here and there, but the idea that someone with a straight face try to make the argument that Kamala Harris isn't a good speaker is frankly, obviously racist. And they're just coming up with stuff to say. Let's take a listen. I want to re-listen to, we took this one yesterday, but I want to start with the Obergefell decision, Brian. And let's set this up since we've got a couple minutes here. Brett Kavanaugh had said during his confirmation hearings that Brown v. Board of Education was one of the greatest moments in the Supreme Court's history. Of course, we're all familiar with the Brown decision. It was the decision that said that separate is not equal. It was absolutely crucial in the civil rights movement. Obergefell was the decision that concluded finally that LGBTQIA folks also cannot be treated as separate but equal, that they, just like Black and Brown folks, are entitled to public education on equal footing as white folks, that in Obergefell, that LGBTQIA folks are entitled to equal protection under the laws and the right to get married, just like straight folks are. So from a civil rights perspective, there's no daylight between those two decisions. And Vice President Harris went right at this point. And it's interesting to watch Brett Kavanaugh, who's supposed to be such a genius, having a hard time managing the Q&A. Let's listen.
And he looks like a whiny little jerk with a scowling face the entire time. Just get that stupid scowling little boy face in front of you while he's speaking.
You like, said Brown v. Boyer was one of the greatest moments in the court's history. Do you believe that Obergefell was also one of those moments?
I've said, Senator, consistent with what the nominees have done, that the vast swath of modern case law, as Justice Kagan put it, you can't, as a nominee in this seat, give a thumbs up or thumbs down. That's her word.
Do you think that Obergefell was one of the great moments in the history of the Supreme Court of the United States?
And for that reason, those nominees have declined to comment on recent cases.
Great moment is what I'm asking you, not to comment on the legal analysis. Do you believe that was a great moment in the history of the court?
So the Justice Kennedy wrote the majority opinion saying the days of treating gay and lesbian Americans or gay and lesbian couples as second-class citizens or inferior in dignity and worth are over in the Supreme Court. That's a very important statement, Senator.
I agree. That's why I think you repeated it. Thank you.
She's asking him a question, not as a lawyer, not as a potential Supreme Court justice. And remember, at the time, Brett Kavanaugh was a sitting judge, an Article III judge. She's asking him, well, if you think Brown v. Board was one of the greatest moments of the court because it was such a monumental step forward for civil rights, just answer the question as to gay folks, as a human being. And Brett Kavanaugh simply could not. Now, in my opinion, Brett Kavanaugh should never have been confirmed, not as a litmus test as to what his belief system is, but because he was proved to be, during the confirmation hearings, emotionally incapable of managing himself under stressful circumstances. And second of all, because the standard of behavior and conduct for the highest court in the land should be higher than basically any other office that I can think of, even higher than the presidency, because they sit for a lifetime. Moreover, his inability to answer as a human being clearly showed where his judicial mindset was, which I also believe would be disqualifying. Meaning, his judicial mindset when it came to Obergefell was, well, that's just the decision. And since I personally don't believe that gay people should be afforded all of the rights that straight people are, I'm going to dodge this question. This wasn't about restraint as a potential judicial nominee. And she caught him dead to rights. That's Kamala Harris, you know, talking poorly. The one who's talking poorly there is Brett Kavanaugh. Let's take a listen to this next one. This is Kamala Harris talking to Brett Kavanaugh. Again, this is in the context of Christine Blasey Ford's accusations against the now Supreme Court justice that he sexually assaulted her. Let's take a listen to her really zeroing in on Brett Kavanaugh, trotted out, oh, I'm friends with lots of women and they all think I'm great. And she goes right to the heart of the matter. Let's listen.
Do you agree that it is possible for men to both be friends with some women and treat other women badly?
Of course, but the point I've been emphasizing, and that is if you go back to age 14 for me, you will find people, and not just people, lots of people who I've been friends with, some of whom are in this room today, starting at age 14, women, and who talked about my friendships with them through my whole life, and it's a consistent pattern all the way through. 65 women who knew me more than 35 years ago signed a letter to support me after the allegation was made because they know me and they were with me and we grew up together. We talked on the phone together and we went to events together. That is who I am. What they've said, what the people who worked with me in the Bush White House, the women there, look at what Sarah Day said in centralmaine.com. Look at the what the law clerks. I have sent more women law clerks to the Supreme Court than any other federal judge in the country.
I only have a few seconds left, and I'll just ask you a direct question. Did you watch Dr. Ford's testimony?
I did not. I plan to. I plan to. Thank you. I plan to, but I did not.
Hey, Brett, binders full of women doesn't really answer the question, right? Which is, you can have binders full, hundreds of women that say, Brett's always been great to me. And that doesn't eliminate the potential that in a different circumstance with a different woman, you behaved differently. That was the point of the question. And again, I think if you're talking about Kamala Harris as a speaker, you cannot just see her speaking skills here, but her thinking skills. Because what she did in that moment was say, oh yeah, you've got all these letters, without conceding that point, and said, but did you listen to the one woman who under oath said that you didn't treat her well, like all these other ladies writing letters about knowing you since 14 and talking on the phone and going to events, weird. Did you listen to the one woman who had something different to say? And his answer was no.
How but pathetic. I plan to.
I'm gonna.
Worth pointing out, lots of people thought that Ted Bundy was very, very, very charming and very kind.
Yeah, those things kind of run together. We'll come back because I think the doozy of doozy is the one that I enjoy the best of Vice President Harris, then Senator Harris, questioning now Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. We'll share with you when you come back. We'll listen to some of the incredible things J.D. Vance has said. I'm Maggie Dawn. That's Brian Kelly. You want to join us or comment? 855-752-4842. 855-75-CIVIC. Keep it locked, everybody. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep on running, cause the winner don't quit on themselves.
I liked beer. I still like beer. Sometimes I had too many beers.
Everybody, I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Let's give away some Brewers tickets, Brian, shall we? Now, I think I might have stumped y'all with a little bit too challenging of a trivia question. So we're going to keep it. It's Friday. Let's keep it casual. Let's keep it easy. Here's your trivia question for two tickets to Tuesday's Brewers Braves game at AmFam Field. The voice of the Brewers, Bob Uecker, starred in which television sitcom from 1985 to 1990? 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Which sitcom did voice of the Brewers, Bob Uecker, star in from 1985 to 1990? You know the question. The first caller with the correct answer will win two club-level tickets to the Brewers-Braves game coming up this Tuesday. You're not going to want to miss that. I love sitting in them seats. We'll give away a couple more pairs before the end of business today, but if you want them now, you can get them now and cross that thing off your to-do list. 855-75-CIVIC. And no, the answer is not Elf, though I also found that to be a highly amusing 80s cartoon, sitcom, I should say. If you don't get the tickets now, Brian's going to let me know if we got a winner in just a second here. If you don't get the tickets, we do have a winner. So folks, hold on to your hats. We'll give more away before the show is out today. I got two more pairs of tickets, so don't worry. If you are not on the phone right now, you have not won the tickets. We do have a winner. So folks, you can go ahead and hang up unless you want to comment on what we're talking about, because we've had fabulous Kamala Harris, you know, speaking well, speaking eloquently, some fabulous sound of her during the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings. And Brian, let me know if you can do 18 things at once and also play what is my personal favorite. This is Kamala Harris asking Brett some questions about what was to become the Dobbs decision. Let's take a quick listen.
Can you think of any laws that give government the power to make decisions about the male body?
I'm happy to answer a more specific question. But
male versus female.
There are medical procedures.
Okay. That the government has the power to make a decision about a man's body?
I thought you were asking about medical procedures that are unique to men.
I'll repeat the question. Can you think of any laws that give the government the power to make decisions about the male body?
I'm not thinking of any right now, Senator.
Yes, Brett, the answer to that is no, because not only do you think the LGBTQIA community are second-class citizens, you think women are second-class citizens. That's why you signed on to the Dobbs decision. That was such a snow job. These Supreme Court justices that gave lip service during their confirmation hearings to stare decisis and respect of precedent are nothing more than liar, liar, pants on fires. I mean, I don't know how else to slice that other than that way. Again, I just think Kamala Harris, incredibly gifted, follows up, knows the art of the Q&A. Brian, if you've got it, let's take this last little bit of Kamala Harris, Brett Kavanaugh sound.
You have said in your opening statement, you characterized these allegations as a conspiracy directed against you. I'll point out to you that Neil Gorsuch, was nominated by this president. He was considered by this body just last year. I did a rough kind of analysis of similarities. You both attended Georgetown Prep. You both attended very prestigious law schools. You both clerked for Justice Kennedy. You were both circuit judges. You were both nominated to the Supreme Court. You were both questioned about your record. The only difference is that you have been accused of sexual assault. How do you reconcile your statement about a conspiracy against you with the treatment of someone who was before this body not very long ago?
I explained that in my opening statement, Senator. Look at the evidence here, the calendars, look at the witness statements, look at Ms. Kaiser's statement.
Okay. And then,
yeah, that question is pure genius, and here's why. What she does is first call out the old boys club, right? She's like, you guys are basically carbon copies of one another. You went to the same stinking high school. You clerked for the same stinking Supreme Court justice. You're the same stinking Ivy League silver spooners. You're both the same stinking age. In other words, it's more of the same, more of the same. That guy got confirmed. There was no conspiracy there, was there, sir? You're claiming that somehow we passed on Gorsuch, but the machinery invented a new conspiracy just for you because you're so special? Or, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, is it the far more likely and reasonable and certainly commonsensical inference to draw that if you and Gorsuch are basically indistinguishable, that indeed this is not some conspiracy of epic historic proportions? Is it far more likely that this woman believes and testified on an oath that you committed sexual assault? Which one, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, do you think is more likely? A vast system-wide conspiracy to block this Supreme Court justice, but not the other one? And he can't respond to that, of course. I mean, it's brilliant. It's quite possibly some of the best Q&A I have heard by a sitting senator during contentious confirmation hearings. Folks, you want to get in your 2 cents, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Of course, the answer to the Brewers trivia question, was Mr. Belvedere. I watched the heck out of that when I was a kid. Certainly enjoyed that program. Congratulations to our winner. We'll give away more tickets before the end of the show. Just stay tuned. We got two more pairs to give away. But now let's turn to some of the crazy things that J.D. Vance has said. Oh, we got only a minute left. We'll get there. We'll get there, Brian. We have time. Hey, we got things to talk about. We're going to be joined next by a guest you've got to hear from. Her name is Bryna Goddard. She's a staff attorney with the State Democracy Research Initiative at the University of Wisconsin Law School. She's going to tell us all about the two constitutional amendments that you'll see on your ballot August 13th. You're going to want to hear what she has to say. Incredibly important. I'm Maggie Dawn. He's Brian Kelly. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked. We'll be back in just a moment. Especially the women made me feel good. Then I'm Maggie Dawn. I got Fancy Brian in the booth with me. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Really excited to bring on my next guest, Bryna Goddard. She's a staff attorney with the State Democracy Research Initiative at the University of Wisconsin Law School. She joined the initiative after clerking with Judge Jeffrey Howard on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit, and she was previously a legal fellow with the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota in St. Paul, Minnesota. She graduated magna cum laude from Harvard, where she was vice president and treasurer of the Harvard Law Review. So, you know, I'm sure Bryna, like Kamala Harris, probably speaks fairly well. So let's bring her on and we'll talk about the two constitutional amendments we're going to see on our August 13th ballot. Again, folks, it is the August 13th primary. The most important thing, in addition to all the primary races that you may find in your locality, are statewide, every single primary ballot on August 13th is going to have not one, but two constitutional amendments on it. Welcome, Bryna, to the show. Thanks so much for making time.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Well, first of all, as a former Badger and a former Federal Appeals Court clerk, very, very nice to have you. Thank you for your service to the University of Wisconsin Law School, as well as the state and at the Democracy Research Initiative. Tell folks what are these two constitutional amendments about and why are we seeing them on the ballot?
So these two amendments are really aimed at the most basic level at giving the legislature a seat at the table in future federal funding decisions, similar to what we saw with the COVID pandemic funding. And part of why we're seeing them is because the legislature wasn't involved in determining how to spend some of that funding. In particular, Governor Evers had quite a bit of discretion with about $4 billion of that, and the legislature really wanted to be more involved in those decisions.
And they're going the constitutional amendment route. Why? I'm right in my understanding that we're seeing constitutional amendments because they tried to change the state statute, which has been on the books for a long time, whereby the legislature gave this power to the governor. They tried to basically repeal or change that statute, and that legislative effort failed. So they're going the roundabout way and trying to put through the constitutional amendments. Do I have that part correct?
Yes, pretty much. So the legislature passed a bill in 2021 that specifically would have given it control over the pandemic-related funding. And Governor Evers vetoed that. And the thing with constitutional amendments in Wisconsin is that they don't require the governor's approval to go to the voters. So the legislature just has to pass the same amendment in two consecutive sessions, which they've already done. And then it goes to voters for a majority vote. And if a majority vote for it, it goes into the Constitution. And it's a way to get around the governor's veto.
I was going to say, it is, in a way, simply bypassing what is a normal democratic process. We have a statewide elected chief executive that gets to veto legislation. And they can't get this done legislatively. So they're end-arounding. And here's the thing, Brenna. I'm always a little bit suspicious about these constitutional amendments, especially when you see split government as you do here, especially when you see allegations of extreme gerrymandering as you see in Wisconsin. Why are Republicans in the legislature so concerned about this? If it was fine back in the day for the governor to do this, why all of a sudden is this not appropriate?
So I think the reason why we're seeing this concern now is specifically because of the pandemic-related funding, which was really an unprecedented amount of funding and gave the governor a lot more control over a much larger sum than we've seen in the past. And I would add, though, too, is this is going around the governor's check on the legislature, but it is taking it directly to the people. And so in some ways, it is almost a more democratic approach of if you're asking voters directly, do you think we should have this or not? And voters getting to actually weigh in there.
Yeah. And again, I'll give the commentary. I don't ask you or expect you to at all, Brenna. But the thing that I find anti-democratic about this is the fact that this was not a concern for Republicans when Scott Walker was a governor and the same statute was in place. This wasn't a concern for state Republicans when the state received hundreds of millions in tobacco settlement funding. And we know what happened to that money. It just dropped to the bottom line of the state's general ledger. It never got into local governments. It never got into local health departments to address that. And I know we're talking about federal funding, but it's part of this whole about how do these appropriations happen? What is the appropriate role, especially in what I would call public health emergencies? The thing that worries me the most is that assuming and taking at face value that this is a response to the pandemic relief, it seems to me to be the wrong thing at this point in time when you have so many Republicans that frankly deny science, deny scientific consensus, that want to politicize especially emergency appropriations coming from federal funds that the governor would make to try to address what are emergency situations relating to public health and safety. I mean, as a taxpayer, as a voter, I get really uncomfortable thinking about people who have said things like mouthwash is going to cure COVID or that sunlight and bleach are going to cure COVID, all of a sudden aligning to decide, well, how are we going to expend emergency federal dollars when we're in the middle of a global pandemic? I mean, is the politics here as brass knuckled as I think it is in terms of this being, frankly, about trying to give what is an anti-science party at the moment control over what is public health emergency funding in some instances?
So I think it's a little more complex than that. That is definitely one of the major concerns of opponents of this amendment, is that it is going to impact that emergency funding when we need it quickly, and it's going to tie things up in partisan wrangling and in more bureaucracy by requiring legislative approval. And so that is definitely a concern of folks who are opposing this amendment. I think more broadly, a lot of the funding that triggered this amendment was some of the later funding that was less immediate, less responsive to the immediate emergency, and more focused on the fiscal recovery side of things. And we didn't just see this debate play out in Wisconsin. This is something across the country. Legislators and executives were really butting heads about how that money should be spent, how it should be prioritized. And the legislature is used to having a primary role in setting the state budget. And so I think it is sort of complex when it comes to what funding we're talking about. And that is one of the unknowns of this amendment, is what funding it would ultimately touch.
Yeah, let's dig into that. And folks, if you've got a question for Brenna, you want to comment on these amendments, 855-752-4842. We welcome those questions. We'll go to the phones in a minute. Here's the other thing that really concerns me, Brenna. When right now, clerks, election clerks in the state are struggling with the vague constitutional amendments that passed the election cycle that basically required that it be very specific official election officers that help operate elections, when it has traditionally been the case that we have a lot of volunteers, a lot of people that step up that aren't necessarily government employees. We have private companies that print ballots, and clerks simply don't know what this means. When I look at these constitutional amendments, I'm not sure what they mean exactly. And so doesn't this open the door not just to additional bureaucratic process, but what could be incredibly protracted legal battles in the courts over these kinds of crucial public health, safety, and welfare funding decisions?
Yes, it is. It would not surprise me if these amendments, if they pass, end up being litigated in court. They have some vagueness to them. An aspect of constitutional amendments is that they're typically less detailed than statutes because they're meant to hold up for decades, centuries, potentially. And so you don't have the granularity that you have in a statute. And this is a difference in Wisconsin versus other states that have handled the pandemic relief funding. Some of those states' legislatures have passed statutes exerting control over the funds from the American Rescue Plan Act, or ARPA. And Wisconsin, I think, would be unique in making a constitutional change to address that. And it has some of those drawbacks of less clarity about what funding it applies to, uncertainty about what the legislative process will look like for approval, and uncertainty about any impact on the state appropriation process as well.
We also have a unique Joint Finance Committee. It's sort of this unicorn of a thing within state government, incredibly powerful. It has, in many ways, sort of final up-down authority over all kinds of things. We know that PFAS funding, though appropriated in the budget, has not yet been expended because it's stuck in the Joint Finance Committee, and a bill came out and then the governor vetoed it. I say all that to say, we're not exactly the bastion of, you know, cooperative consensus building to get important funding out into the communities that need it most. Let's take a couple of questions. Linda from Eau Claire, please say hi to Attorney Godar. And Brian, what's your question or comment this afternoon, Linda?
Thank you. Hello, everybody. If you want a good example of the fiscal responsibility that the Republicans have, we're hurting for health care up here in the Chippewa Valley. We've had two hospitals closed and all kinds of clinics. And that finance committee is sitting on, what is it, $15 million? They won't release it. And it's been going on for months. All you got to do, people, is take a look at what's happening with the health care financing and help from the state here in the Chippewa Valley.
Thanks so much, Linda, for the comment. Brenna, what do you say about that? I think there are many people, whether we're talking about folks in the Chippewa Valley that are facing extraordinary constrictions in healthcare providers. We're talking about people frustrated about childcare funding, people frustrated about getting PFAS remediation funding going. At a very high level, Attorney Godar, would these constitutional amendments help expedite getting those sorts of appropriations done, or on balance, is it going to bog it down more?
It really depends on how it's implemented, and that's one of the big uncertainties, because one of the specifically floated ideas in a prior version of this amendment was to give the Joint Committee on Finance approval power over federal funding spending decisions. And so depending on what that committee looks like after the next election, you might see it operating similarly to what we've seen in the past.
Again, at this point in time in state government, incredibly partisan, and it leads to roadblocks. A question from John texting in from WISS, would these amendments also force FEMA funding or natural disaster relief from the federal government to go through the legislature? What do you think, Attorney Godar?
It's not completely clear. It seems like this amendment should only impact funding that comes into the governor and that is not designated for a specific purpose. And so that would specifically cover things like this broad ARPA funding that the governor had a lot of discretion in deciding how to spend that. But it's really not clear beyond that, how designated does the funding need to be? How much discretion is too much discretion? And that's something that I think we might see teased out in court.
We'll take more of your thoughts and questions. We've got attorney Brenna Godar with the State Democracy Research Initiative at the University of Wisconsin Law School. We're talking about the two constitutional amendments that you'll see on your August 13th ballot. If you're on the phone, stay there. If you want to get your 2 cents, nickel or a quarter in, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
The biggest fear that I and I think a lot of our supporters have is the outside money.
I don't know about you all, but I'll be voting no on the two constitutional amendments that we'll be seeing on our August 13th ballots across the state. If you want to ask a question of my very special guest, Brenna Godar, a staff attorney with the State Democracy Research Initiative at the University of Wisconsin Law School, now is the time, folks. 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Two of our texters expressing some of the skepticism that I certainly have, Brenna. Kurt from Madison saying, give me an example of a time when Senate Republicans demonstrated that they were going to compromise, engage in bipartisanship, and get funding going that helped average Wisconsinites. I hear your skepticism, Kurt, out of Madison. John, again, from Oshkosh on WISS line, doesn't seem like a bad idea to have some oversight, but given the current state of Republican politics, I am skeptical. That's where I'm at. I mean, in general, I think, you know, legislative oversight, legislatures traditionally have the power of the purse, and it requires, again, cooperation between the executive branches and the legislative and executive branches. Here, however, listen, I don't want people that don't believe in science to, you know, deciding or holding up funding that is crucial for public health, welfare, and safety. We're going to go to the phones. Tom from Jackson, I'm going to take you in just 1 second, but I wanted to get this in. Here's what really worries me, aside from the sort of cynical partisanship of it, Brenna, is the language here. We were talking about the vagueness, especially this. Again, the constitutional amendments are posed as questions to voters, which you then answer either yes or no. But the text of one amendment would end up being this: the legislature may not delegate its sole power to determine how monies shall be appropriated. There's so much in there, Brenna. Give us a little flavor of why that is so problematically vague.
Yeah, so this one's a little hard to unpack. I think it's easier to understand the intent by sort of looking at a prior version of this, which was really aimed at keeping the legislature from giving away a power to the governor again to let the governor accept these undesignated funds and determine how to allocate them. So really, it was sort of intended as a backup to question two of making sure the legislature stays involved in this process. What is kind of complicated about it is the legislature has the power to appropriate state funds. It is less clear whether the legislature already has the power to appropriate federal funds. And this is getting into the weeds a little bit about what appropriate means, but this is just something that has been litigated in other states. And it's something that is really just not clear here in Wisconsin.
And I'll just tie that back to folks, if you're a layperson, appropriations and spendings, and it's appropriated but not actually allocated, all of these things have very specific state and state budget and legal meanings. But what you had mentioned before, Brenna, and I just want to emphasize this, is we're talking about federal monies that are usually coming for some kind of a purpose, but it's not so specifically designated that there's no reasonable question about how it has to be expended. It's federal monies that have some discretion built in, such as some of the ARPA dollars that came in during the COVID pandemic. Tom from Jackson, say hello to Attorney Godar. And Brian, what is your question or comment this afternoon? Tom, are you there? We may have lost time. I want to, again, go back to that idea of what this is appears to apply to, Attorney Godar, is federal dollars that have some purpose that is stated, but again, have some discretion. That's what it's supposed to apply to. Am I right in hearing from you that the limitations of how this would impact federal dollars coming into the state, even if does it apply if it's very specific in response to, say, a flood or a train derailment or something like that? Does it apply there? Or again, or is it uncertain?
So I think this could be litigated, so don't hold me to this after the court case. But I think the way that it would most likely apply is it would not apply to that really specific designated federal funding that's going already to a specific program, to a specific municipality, to something like that. And it also wouldn't apply to money going to somebody other than the governor. So for example, UW funding goes to the Board of Regents.
Understood.
What it probably would apply to is the really broad discretion funding like ARPA. And where we have a lot more gray area is that funding that falls in between. So funding that maybe is designated for a broad purpose, but doesn't have the specific line item designation in the same way. And I think that gray area is where we're going to see the most uncertainty.
Tom from Jackson, I think we've got you now. Say hello to Attorney Godar. What's your question or comment?
Well, I'd like to say is that one thing that's not been brought up is that something as important as a constitutional amendment should only be during a major election, like the presidential election this fall. This summer one favors one side versus the other, and that's wrong. So I'd like to say that. And I think also these questions should be plain speak. It shouldn't be confusing the way you're saying, Maggie.
That's my Tom, I couldn't agree with you more. Listen, these are my words, not Attorney Godar's. This is partisan. This is about trying to handcuff what Republicans anticipate to be a democratically held state a governor's mansion for quite some time. That's the trends that we're seeing. It's to handcuff Democratic governors. It's being done in this off election in a summer primary that people tend to, where voter turnout tends to be quite low. And the wording, again, not as clear as it needs to be. The implications not as clear as they should be. That's why it's so important for Attorney Godar to be here to explain it to all of us. Last words, Brenna, about this. What do you want people to know as they go into the voting booths on August 13th?
I think it's just really important to think about both the intended impact of these amendments as well as the unknown impacts that we've been talking about. And then really to also just think about what sort of system design you would want for this in any sort of government, whether that is a really divided partisan government, or if it is a more united government, and if that goes both ways, governor and legislature. I think that's really important when making these broader constitutional design decisions.
Thanks so much, Berna Godar, staff attorney with the State Democracy Research Initiative at the University of Wisconsin Law School. I know I'm a bit smarter about this. Hope you all feel the same way, too. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network, president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Rob Henken is up next. We're talking about sales tax revenues. Don't go anywhere.
You know, they can go suck lemons.